Hi, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. What's up today?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
A little bit under the weather. I'm not wearing my normal garb because I have a bit of a cold. So I'm not going to talk anymore. It's your turn.
I'm sorry you're feeling bad, but we're going to get through our podcast tonight, and everybody will send you the best wishes for getting better soon.
Please consider clicking the like or subscribe button that's down below. And you also find in the description of this video everything related to the Paranormalist Podcast, the Facebook groups, email address, and all of the associated other things with it, including Patty's books on Amazon. So thank you. And here we go with the episode.
So are you ready to get going?
I am.
All right. So about a week or two ago, I was doing some reading about Jacques Vallée. For those who aren't familiar, you're gonna get to know a little bit about him today, and about why he is different than anybody else in the paranormal field. So we're gonna talk about something called ultra-terrestrials. Now, everybody's used to the idea of extraterrestrials, meaning beings from other planets, places, what have you, who come to the Earth for whatever the reason and interact with humanity for whatever that reason is. It could be to help us, to harm us, to just collect data from us, whatever. Now, back in the 1950s, Jacques Vallée was a young man living, he was born in France, and he was 16 years old. He was watching the sky and he saw a UFO. It was the first time he'd ever encountered anything unusual. It captured his imagination and his attention, and he was just completely struck by this event, just watching this thing moving through the sky. And he would go forward in his life and become, he worked as a scientist and astrologer, or studying the sky, and he was fascinated. He also became very conversant with computer sciences. And over the course of his work in the United States as his young man, there's a night he's looking, as an astronomer, he's looking through a telescope, and he's watching this object. And he's watching it moving across the sky. It's moving erratic. It's going forward, backward, jumping, doing things that normal things don't do. And as he's watching it, making notes, just completely fascinated, it just goes away. Right in front of him. It didn't fall to the ground. It didn't explode. It was just there, not. And this is where he begins to formulate the idea of ultra-terrestrial. So ultra-terrestrials are a belief in ufology that there are other beings sharing the planet with us, and that these beings have been here since the beginning of time, that they may or may not come in and out of our dimension, but they're all centered on the Earth, even if they're interdimensional and they move from our dimension to other dimensions, which would explain a lot of some of the paranormal things that we talk about, where something comes from one world to another and back again. And he's not the only person to have proposed this, but he's the first person to propose it. So over the course of his work in the United States, he meets J. Allen Hynek, who was a resource for Project Blue Book. He was an expert for them. And they begin to discuss all of this. And Hynek kind of has a epiphany. Like, he was being paid to shoot down UFO stories. The government was paying. He freely admits this as an older gentleman, that, you know, he had been hired specifically to shoot down UFO stories. But at some point, Hynek goes, wait a second. they can't all be a lie. You know, like he begins to feel that he's sold out his scientific credibility. And so he begins to parse these cases apart in a different way. And he reaches out and he's talking to Jacques Vallée. And at that time, there was a lot of interest in if UFOs were real, if they weren't real, and, you know, what should the government do about it? And should the American public know anything about it? And there was a university that was holding a round table, if you would, of people who were in the field. And it was being held and chaired by a guy by the name of Condren. Now, Condren, anybody who's ever been in this field for any length of time knows that he created, from this particular roundtable conference, he creates something called the Condren Report. And the Condren Report is basically that he doesn't believe that there's much real about UFOs. And if there is, the general public should not have any knowledge, and that the government needs to take this stuff and hide it away from the public because they're not emotionally and psychologically ready to deal with it. And it's exactly what we've experienced as a nation and of people since the beginning. And he's endorsing that methodology. Interestingly enough, two of the people who applied to participate at this conference in Boulder, Colorado, were J. Allen Hynek and Jacques Vallée, both of who were refused admittance to the conference, literally refused to be allowed to speak or attend, based solely on the fact that they had not publicly disavowed the concept of UFOs being real and there being something out there that they were not prepared to say were aliens from outer space. They were willing to state, we do believe that UFOs exist, we just don't know what they are, where they come from, or what their interaction with humanity is about. Which honestly seems like the probably most realistic and scientific way to approach this. Because nobody did know, to the best of our knowledge. So to say, you know, I believe in UFOs, I believe they exist, I believe that there's something going on, but I don't know what it is really the only straightforward answer anybody with integrity could have had. But Condren and the government go after Vallée and J. Allen Hynek, and they try to shut him down. Vallée is so disheartened by what happens to him and his reputation in the United States that he moves back to France and he goes back to becoming a professor, and he doesn't want to deal with it for a long time. And then he gets to looking into Carl Jung, the psychologist, his work. Now, Jung had a fascination with UFOs, and he believed UFOs were modern mythology in the making, much like we have fairies and religious mythology and goblins and witches and vampires that are all a mythology based on something. He believes, Carl Jung made the argument that UFOs and UFO interactions were a form of modern mythology being created today. It's a possibility.
Interesting way to look at it.
It is. Now, he created, Jung went through and pulled together all this information talking about similarities in Europe's fairies, goblins, gnomes, the short alien beings that are being reported by UFOs, the results of being abducted, you know, fairies kidnap you and they take you to the fairy realm, you lose time, you come back, maybe you're amnesic about what happened, or, you know, people don't believe you because it's so incredible that, you know, it defies logic. much like UFO events. You will have these small beings that take you on board a ship, take you elsewhere, do things to you. A lot of times there's missing time or things happening to you that you can't tell others because people would doubt you and call you crazy. So that was where Jung came in. Now, the reason that's important is because Valet, reading all of this, looking at all of this, begins to parse apart these stories, realizing that maybe Jung's onto something. Maybe not necessarily that this is modern mythology, but maybe that these beings have always existed in our realm, and they have chosen to present themselves with patent absurdity because it hides and cloaks their legitimate self and what they're interested in with us. And he begins to pull all this apart, and he starts looking at the history of humanity and its interaction with bizarre beings. And he sees that parallel that Jung makes between gnomes, fairies, things like that, and alien beings. And he starts to say, what if all of it is this way? What if there are these beings that have existed in our, on our planet for millennia, maybe from the beginning? And that these beings, all the way back to angelic and demonic beings, have been able to shape shift in and out of time using different dimensions and interacting with us to create our mythology, guide us sometimes for educational purposes and sometimes to sabotage us. And sometimes they want something else from us, like blood or energy or different things. And he's like, what if they don't come from outer space? What if they're not mythology? What if they all exist? And this is why they can maneuver and manipulate us so in so many crazy ways. And immediately I started thinking about the 1972-73 Bigfoot UFO flap in Pennsylvania, where the UFOs are seen with Bigfoots, and Bigfoots pop like soap bubbles, and alien craft pop in and out of reality. And one of the arguments Valet makes is that these things are multi-paranormal. So like when you are looking at a UFO encounter, it could be just a UFO encounter, but it likewise could also incorporate poltergeist-like activity, objects moving in and out of reality, moving through space. Like there's 1,000 stories of people who were kidnapped out of their bedrooms and walked through a wall or floated through a closed window, and then woke up in a spaceship where there's 5 different types of beings looking at them. And they all pass on psychically different messages. Maybe the ones that look sort of humanoid are saying to them, it's going to be okay. The reptilians like, go ahead and do it. And, you know, the next one, the little grays are like, it won't hurt too much, I promise. And so, you know, there's multiple things going on at the same time. I found that fascinating. So Valet starts proposing this. He is the first one to say this. Now, John Keel, everybody knows him from Point Pleasant and the Mothman and what have you. John Keel will actually be the one who comes up with the ultra-terrestrial title. And he does so independently based upon what happened with the Mothman at Point Pleasant. But then he and Valet eventually start talking because they're both talking about the same thing. And they decide to meet and talk, and they realize they're basically chasing down the same rabbit hole. And in a book called Passport to Magonia by Jacques Valet, he begins to talk about this subject. He would write several more books, and his books are fascinating. And in the books, he makes the argument that throughout all history, we've had paranormal beings that have appeared. In medieval Europe, there are stories of strange human beings and flying ships. You can look at paintings of the Madonna and the Christ child, and there's UFOs in the sky in the background. You know, things like that that have appeared forever. During the Industrial Revolution, these beings reported themselves to be pilots from Mars. Like they would, if you go read the 1940s and 50s, encounters, they were the Aryan beings or the small or the tall grays. And then whenever they were asked where they came from the Andromeda or Mars or some other place. And people took this as gospel and they began to preach what today we would call, I don't want to be rude, but it's woke ideology about the planet and, you know, ecosystems, and you're going to blow the planet up and you're going to destroy your ecosystem. So they began to do this. So that was kind of the message you got a lot in the like 30s, 40s, 50s. And yeah, then as we began, go ahead.
Yeah, you look at the movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still, you know, that 1950, 53, 54, you know, had that message.
Yeah, it was a very common message in the that eco terrorist, you know, kind of message saying, oh, you need to stop doing everything. Don't mess with this. And you're going to kill the world and blah, blah, blah. And that wasn't the message 30 years earlier from these same beings when they appeared. And then you move into the 50s, 60s, 70s, and now we have these jet planes, and our craft that are coming here are not ships, you know, like literally ships, like ships that sailed on the ocean in the 1800s. Now they look like disc-shaped saucers, and they have small grays in them, and they talk without, in your head, telepathically. And they become very scientific and they're doing experiments. You know, you just look at Betty and Barney Hill and what their story was and how traumatized they were by this. But they're the same thing, just changing their message and changing their vehicle to always stay ahead of us. And to always convince us that they are smarter, better than we are, and to influence our willingness and our ability to do things. They're controlling us through mythology, but they deliberately make it so bizarre that to say it out loud makes you feel stupid. And when you say it out loud, other people doubt you. When people started talking about getting impregnated by aliens that then came back and stole the fetus, everybody said these people are mentally ill. And then John Mack comes out and he begins to, who's a Harvard psychiatrist and professor, and he starts going and getting these people physically tested. And they're like, oh my gosh, yeah, this person was pregnant. Here's the pregnancy test. You know, here's the sonogram. And now here's the scarring. The fetus is missing. And, you know, but when you started hearing people talk about it, everybody thought they were insane. So the story keeps going that way. And, you know, like we don't talk much about it, but there are all these bizarre stories from the 1800s of UFOs interacting with human beings. For example, there's a farmer from Texas in 1878 that talks about a large saucer that he saw land on his farm. Two humanoid figures, not human, but humanoid figures, came out with buckets, which makes no sense at all, and said to him, may we fill our craft up? We need water to continue to fly. And he was like, sure, there's the well right over there. Go pump the water. And he's sitting on his porch watching these humanoid figures, you know, do this. But if you go back to 1180 in Japan, luminous objects described as earthenware vessels were flying and stopping and asking if the Japanese people would allow them to fill their vessels with water because they needed water to travel. It's an interesting story. I mean, we're talking thousands of years. So I found it really interesting. So we're going to start talking about what does this mean. In 1575, there's a gentleman by the name of Pierre Beausoleil who was in Western Europe. He claimed that the face of heaven, this is what he saw. He said he was looking into the sky and there was a supernatural manifestation. And I'm going to read exactly how he describes it. The face of heaven has been so often disfigured by bearded, hairy comets, torches, flames, columns, spears, shields, dragons, duplicate moons, suns, and other things that if one wanted to tell it in an orderly fashion, those that have had this happen since the birth of Jesus Christ only and inquire about the cause of their origin, the lifetime of a single man would not be enough to describe them all. It's quite a statement.
Yes,
it is. It's quite a statement. So we're going to go down through some and really and talk about them. In 1593, there's a book that was written in Germany that talks about the sun. About the sun, many dark clouds appeared, such as we are wont to see during great storms, and soon afterward have come from the sun other clouds, all fiery and bloody, and others yellow and saffron. Out of these clouds came forth reverberations resembling large, tall, wide hats. That would look like a spacecraft. And the earth showed itself yellow and bloody and seemed to be covered with hats, tall and wide. That's a lot of spacecraft. If you're looking and the sky is filled with them, which appeared in various colors, such as red, blue, green, and most of them black. It is easy for everyone to think of the meaning of this miracle, which is that God wants to introduce man to amend their lives and make penance. May Almighty God inspire men to recognize him. This is this man describing this and taking out of it what his interpretation of it was. And we could go all the way from the beginning of time. Any place there's been writing, and it's all through the Bible. For example, the pillar of fire that led the Israelites, the Ezekiel's wheel. There's 100 different references, light angels that appear out of nowhere. But we're going to move forward a little bit because I want to get to some of the stories. We're going to talk about these beings create myths about themselves that, and I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the stories. So we're going to look at some of the actual stories of people have told of things that have created myths. So Valet starts pushing all this stuff and he's literally called a heretic. Like, I don't know if people realize it, not this, but everything is political in life, everything. If you're a Bigfoot person and you say, well, hey, there's a classification of Bigfoots that are interdimensional and they pop like soap bubbles when you shoot at them and they seem to be attached to UFOs and working with aliens, whatever that means, I promise you, you're not going to be the guy that gets the TV show. Because as Jeff Meldrum put it, you know, they have worked for so many years to convince people that a 8 to 10 foot tall bipedal hominid of biological origin is walking in the American Northwest, that to go from that to interdimensional beings would take away the credibility of all that hard work. I get his argument.
Yeah, I mean, but that's science. Science has to be, you have to have a hypothesis, peer review. It has to be reproducible. And it seems like in today's society, anybody questioning science is anti-science, when in fact, that's exactly what science is.
Yep, I agree completely. And that's the problem. Science is you propose something, somebody else comes along, they look at it, they question it, they argue it, somebody else comes out and says, hey, wait, about what about this point? And then you all debate it together and come up with a consensus, which then will shift as more facts arrive. You don't start out with the conclusion and then force and twist and torture your data to make it fit your conclusion. And if you do that, that's not science. So Valet is, you know, he's still out there, he's still talking, and now he comes up with something which is really heretical. He begins to argue that the United States Air Force does not have any evidence of UFO caches. He argues that they're not willing to talk about it because they honestly don't know. But they're using it politically to control people. That sense of, you know, we really, and think about it, it's pretty much what they did. They're like, well, no, we don't have anything, any UFOs. What are you people talking about? But, you know, aliens might be out there. And if they are, you know, they, you might need our protection from them. So Valet says the quiet part out loud, which you can imagine does not endear him to anybody. He's like, you know, if they had a UFO craft, they would be showing it to you. They would be willing to, you know, put it out there to scare you, to control you. So I don't think they have this stuff. They don't. They're lying. They're lying to control you because they don't have anything to show you that would frighten you. And then he says, these creatures that are here, they are here to alter human beliefs. And he says that they're inconsistent, they're contradictory, they make no sense on purpose. They're literally creating absurdities and using it to undermine human belief systems and logic in order to control humanity. And he's like, and that's exactly what the government does. It propagandizes you to do the same thing. So if you can see your government doing it, why can't you see other creatures doing it? We laugh at vampires unless we were walking down the street at Bourbon Street in, you know, New Orleans at 3 o'clock in the morning and some shadowy figures behind you. There's that moment when it doesn't seem like such a stretch at that point, you know? I live in the woods, and I have to tell you, my one son has come up out of the woods with a gun, and because he lives further down than I do, and he's like, did you hear it? And I'm like, no, I didn't hear anything. Did you hear it? Something hit the side of my house. And I'm like, no, honey, I didn't hear anything. And he's like, Mom, I'm telling you, it's the third night in a row something's hit the side of the house. Now, in the light of day, he goes, okay, it might have been a deer. It might have been a cat jumping off the roof. It might have been a... But in that moment, even when he doesn't say it, I know he's thinking Bigfoot. And we've all had those moments.
Cameras are inexpensive nowadays.
I actually pointed it out to him. I said we should really get some game cams and just kind of solve that mystery. So that's on my shopping list, believe me. So I wanted to talk a little bit about how these things have morphed through time. So in the 1800s, there was this huge flap of ships. And when I say ships, I mean ships like sail on the sea ships that were flying through the air. There were 18 states that reported credible reports of multiple people seeing these ships, either in the air or on the ground, and the beings, and in some of these cases, attempts to communicate with them. So I wanted to share a little bit of this. They were seen from Aurora, Texas, to Oklahoma, Nebraska, Missouri, California, Arizona, all over this country and all over the world. Other places had them too. The ships ranged from about 30 feet to 200 feet. They were moving at speeds estimated at 135 to 150 miles an hour in the late 1800s. There was nothing on this planet at that point in time that moved like that. So one of the very first of these sightings happened in 1896, Sacramento, California. Literally a ship sailed through the sky, and hundreds of witnesses described it as a giant cigar-shaped ship with wheels on the side and what they defined as an electric arc lamp propelled by a mysterious force. There were two human figures seated at this apparatus. And after this mass sighting, we're talking hundreds of people, like in a city, looking up at the sky and going, what the heck is that? And it gets close enough, they can see the features of these beings that look human-like, but not quite human. So then after that, they start tracking this thing. So they realize that it comes from Sacramento, it heads east, and in Chicago, it's seen again by multiple people. And in Chicago, there's what may be a possible alien abduction attempt. And it's fascinating. So I wanted to share it. So between November of 1896 and April of 1897, literally thousands of people claim to have seen this ship. It passed through 18 states. Now, some described it, and it's interesting because it didn't always look exactly the same. Some described it as having wings or sails. Others said propellers. There was others that said they couldn't figure out how it was moving, what was causing it to move. Intricate machinery, contraptions, things they couldn't explain, but they would draw diagrams of what they thought it looked like. Beings and people or creatures that looked almost human-like, that trilled, cooed, chirped, gibbered, and talked, but not in a form that human beings could understand. Now, just to put this in perspective, this is 60 years before the Wright brothers and Kitty Hawk. So, we're taking this next account from the Quincy Morning Whig, which was a newspaper in Quincy, Illinois, and this is where our alien abduction begins. So at the time, there was a craft that appeared about 500 feet above the ground. There was there were people sitting in the craft who were described as long, tall and slender beings. The craft itself was cigar-shaped, made of bright metal, and on either side was a hull that extended upward and outward and appeared to be like wings. And this is, you know, what they're seeing. And then we come across this. And just as an aside, as I'm going down to the actual, I want to reshare the information. But this actually got so much a press that our scientists and our inventors were being contacted and asked, are you doing it? Edison was accused of building this ship, but he denied it and said, I only build things.
He would have stolen.
Yes, actually, yeah. Which maybe why he said I only build things that I make profit on. So here this goes. So there's this guy by the name of Colonel Shaw, and he's traveling with a lady companion, Camille Spooner, and they're in a horse and carriage in Lodi, California. The horse comes up short and just stops. It won't go forward any further. And that's when they look up into the sky and they see the craft, just like what we had described. They talked about seeing strange beings that resembled humans, but were nothing like any human they had ever seen. They were 7 feet tall, very thin, and they tried to whip the horse to get moving and get away, and the horse just balked. It wouldn't move at all. So then now they're stuck there. They're looking at this thing as it comes down. As there's three of these beings that come out of the craft and walk toward them, and the guy he really doesn't have any choice. He's got to try to get a little blustery and make it through this because the horses ain't going. So he tries to talk to the people, these beings, and asks them where they're from, but he calls it a warbling sound came out of them, as though they were talking in these warbling song, bird-like song voices. And they didn't say anything that made any sense to him. And then they realized very quickly that they weren't making sense to the human. So they begin to do that warbling sound amongst themselves as though they're discussing, how do we communicate with this thing? And he said at that point, they stopped warbling and began this monotonous chant, very low and guttural. And he said, I realized there's no point in trying to talk to them. So he said, we got out of the horse and buggy and walked toward them, which I can't fathom, but he did. That's what he says. And he said, I noticed as I got closer, their hands are quite small and delicate, their fingers without nails. Their feet, however, were twice as long as an ordinary man's foot, though they were long and narrow and their toes slender and long. I noticed, too, that they were able to use their feet and toes much like a monkey, like to grip and to hold on to things, and that they appeared to use their feet as much as their hands. And he said they had no clothing on, as we define clothing. And he said that they had this shimmering, gauzy skin on them, which, I mean, I don't know if you would call maybe a uniform of some sort of synthetic material that. And then this is the most interesting part of this story, is that he then talks about the fact that he reached out to touch one of them. And he said, when I touched it, I lifted it by its chin with one finger. It was as though it had no weight. And he said, it reached out to touch me and couldn't move me. At which point, three of them came at him and again tried to lift him. He got the distinct impression they were trying to take him. At the same time, three other ones came out of the craft and attempted to take the young lady with him, but they couldn't budge them due to their mass. At that point, they gibbered amongst themselves a little bit and went back to the ship, got back in, and the ship took off. And he was left feeling that they had attempted to take him and the female. And, you know, he talked about interesting things. Like, he said that one of them had what looked like an egg-shaped device from which a penetrating light shot out. Is that a laser?
A lot of the things you've been describing, the set, like bird-like sounds, the stature, the color, the uniform, the craft even, were almost at exactly as described by Charles Hall in his Millennial Hospitality series, and especially in the first book when he describes the tall white aliens. Yeah. And he said hearing them talk sounded like he thought they were meadowlarks.
So that's interesting.
Very similar to what you're doing. And they had told him, I believe, that they had been visiting our planet for thousands of years. So maybe maybe at that point they were so bold as to be able to let the people touch them. But according to Hall, whenever he knew that he shouldn't touch them.
Right.
or else they would, do something bad for him. But.
Well, maybe somebody had touched him in the past and they realized that it has a germ or something on, I don't know. But it was just a fascinating story because, like, you could see, okay, I could see the silky, velvety skin that was so beautiful and smooth being maybe a uniform. I could see the egg-shaped thing that shot the penetrating light to be a laser. I could, like, you could go back over this, and if you were using late 1800s vernacular, you wouldn't know things like it was a laser light, it was a this, it was a, you know, whatever. So you would just try to describe it the best you could. You know, and that's basically what this guy and this woman did, is they tried to explain what happened to them in the terms of their day. But it didn't take a lot of imagination to see a metal cigar-shaped craft, you know, and these beings, and that they didn't they defied they defied gravity. They had almost no weight. Does that mean that they're not literally biologically here, that they're interdimensional? That what's going on? What's causing that? I don't know. But this is stuff that ultra-terrestrial researchers are looking at, because that's very much like the fairies. That's very much like the vampires. That's very much like, you know, all these creatures from history. You know, how do you define them? Because maybe the terminology changes from the days of Christ to the 1700s to the 1800s to the 1900s to here we are, 2024. But the same phenomena is happening over and over. And they're not giving us great mounds of knowledge, and they're not sending us to the Stone Age. So what's their purpose? You know, either one of those would be a great argument, except they're not doing either of those things, but they are influencing us, our mythology, our religion. They're misleading us in different directions. They're watching us in so many ways. So I believe a long time ago, I had touched on a case called the Van Meter monster, and it was from Van Meter, Iowa. I apologize. And, you know, this was one of the creatures that were going to head towards Mothman territory. And this predates Mothman, but it's fascinating. 1903, it's the middle of the late evening, and there's a guy by the name of Griffith who is headed home from work to get something to eat and get ready and go to bed. He's tired. It's been a long day. And he sees a bright light from a rooftop of a neighbor's house. And he's like, what is that? The place on fire? He means 1903. And so he starts watching it and walking toward it rather than going into his house. And that's whenever he gets close enough to see what he describes as a humanoid creature that's black with wings and a horn on its head from which shoots a penetrating light that is so bright it literally blinds him. That's the very first sighting of this. He's a businessman. Everybody in town knows him. They, you know, next day he tells this fantastical tale about how he did this. He saw this. He had taken his gun with him when he had carried it on the way home from work, because, you know, he was a shopkeeper, so people robbed you, so you had something to keep yourself safe, and he would walk home with it every night instead of leaving it in the store. And he said he shot at this thing 5 times. It did not respond, even though he was absolutely positive he had hit it on at least 4 or 5 of the shots. It flew to the rooftop of the next house over, and then into the night. But it gave no sound, no indication it had any response to the bullets hitting it. So, you know, he tells everybody about it, about this bizarre thing that happened. And had he been a guy of lesser character, I'm sure they would have laughed him out of the town, but he wasn't. So the next day he tells his story. And then on the following night, September 30th, their local doctor, Dr. Alcott, wakes up in the middle of the night to this bright light blinding him. And he looks out, and sitting on a telephone pole right outside his window is this creature. And he's horrified by what he sees. He grabs a pistol that he keeps in his bedroom, shoots at the thing, and it just sort of looks at him like, why are you shooting at me? So he runs downstairs and outside. He tries to shoot at it. It starts going. It starts hopping. Sort of hopping, floating, flying. And that's exactly what he calls it. He's like, it sort of leapt into the air and began to float. And then the wings started to move and it flew. And then it was just gone. It had bat-like wings. Again, the horn with the bright light on its head. Kind of reminded me of a Cyclops light from today. Like, the more I thought about it, you know, that would be a very easy definition of it for today. So he does this, and he next morning he's talking about, oh my gosh, the guy wasn't lying, this thing really happened. And this continues over the next week. there's a gentleman named Clarence Dunn who runs the town bank. He is at the bank late at night finishing up, and he sees the thing right outside the bank. At first, he thinks bank robbers are trying to break into the bank because, you know, it's after hours and dark and really late. And then he comes face to face with this thing right outside the bank door. And he's terrified. Again, he talks about it, it making these bizarre sounds like strangling, gasping for air sounds. He shot at it and it took off flying. No blood, no anything. He swore he hit it. There's none of this. This continues on day after day. People are, every night, somebody's encountering this thing. And they're usually decent people. You know, people that could have testified in court for anything. Then there's a gentleman who runs the hardware store. His name's Sidney Gregg. And now his was interesting because he talks about it being on the telephone pole too, like looking in a window at him. And when he goes running outside with a gun to shoot it, he says it had a large parrot-like beak, and it used the beak to help itself climb down the pole, did the run, hop, fly thing, and was gone. Also had the headlight on its head that from that horn that was exceedingly bright. So eventually, there's at the edge of town, there's this local business. They build bricks, and it's on a property where there had been a coal mine. The entrance to the coal mine is on the property, at least one of the entrances, but the mine has been played out and nobody has been in the mine for quite a long time. So the gentleman who owns the brick factory, everybody's antsy. They're all kind of patrolling the streets at night now. They're scared. I mean, multiple people have seen it, all describe it the same way. They're all the town fathers. You know, they're not talking to Joe who like bends his elbow way too much at the bar. These are guys that have a lot of credibility. So anyhow, he's at his brick factory. He hears this noise, this gasping, warbling noise. And he starts looking to find out what the source of the noise is. And it leads him to the opening to the mine. And there standing in the mine entrance is this being, this bat-winged being, and a smaller one just like it. He's completely freaked out. And so he takes off running for town, yelling. They come running out. Multiple people see the two monsters, if you will, and they shoot at it. At the two of them, and the things don't seem to have any response. So they decide to just keep them inside of there till the morning. And then in the morning, they blow up the entrance and close up the mine shaft. Now, all of this can be followed through newspaper accounts, journal entries, letters. There's a pretty decent record that exists for this having happened. In fact, in their centennial book, later on, they put the story of the Van Meter monster and photographs of each of the guys who said they saw it and the coal mine and all of this. So, it has some pretty decent documentation. And doesn't it sound an awful lot like the thing that was seen at Point Pleasant?
It seems incredulous that it seems like the first response of everybody was, let's shoot the thing.
Well, I mean, in fairness, if this thing looks pretty grody, I guess I would probably want to not have to tangle with it either. And they were afraid of it, you know, whatever it was. It definitely didn't look human. So, but it was, you know, let's just get rid of it. It's a terrible looking thing and it doesn't seem to want to, it doesn't respond to the biology the way we know it. So nothing scared it off. And that takes us to Point Pleasant. John Keel. John Keel came into this thing. He wasn't a big, he didn't start out being a in the field of the paranormal. He wasn't interested in monsters. It wasn't his gig. Something happened that caught his interest, and that's what took him to that world. And so he's researching these sightings of this Mothman character, this large bipedal hominid thing with wings, bat-like wings, that flies, that doesn't respond to being shot at, and dogs get attacked by it, and there's no indication that these very big mean dogs wounded it. And it's living in the old abandoned ammo building that had been building ammunition. It was an ammunition dump, basically a place, a plant that built ammunition for a war. And then after the war was over, it was abandoned. But it was right outside of town, and it was very dark and dank and kind of like a mine, you know. It was that cadaverous, cavernous thing. And it was seen there. It chased cars. It flew fast enough to literally keep up with a car going down a highway trying to get away from it. And then it was bad enough that was going on, and it was fascinating. And like I said, Kiel kind of just fell into that story. But then other things start happening. People he interviews start calling him up and saying, there were these men in black. Now, this is before we all talked about men in black. They were here, and they warned me that if I talk to you again, something really terrible is going to happen. So I don't want to talk to you anymore. I'm really afraid. These guys were creepy. Like, I don't think they were people. And then people's televisions blew up. And I don't mean ATV blew up. I mean multiple people who talked to him are sitting there watching their TV in the next couple days, and the TV blows up. Vroom. And electrical things in the houses go haywire, and wires catch fire in walls, and then people have more encounters with these strange things that show up out of nowhere, knock on the door, bizarre looking things that don't look human, but they've got their faces painted as though they were, you know, they're white and pale, and they've drawn on lips and eyebrows, and you know they're obviously not human, but they're attempting to look like that. And then they start harassing him. And then he goes back home to, we're talking Point Pleasant, West Virginia, for those who don't know. He goes back home to New York, where he's from, and he's getting bizarre phone calls in the middle of the night, and it's like gibberish voices or warbling bird calls, and then a male voice coming on, very metallic sounding, "You will stop investigating Point Pleasant. No one wants you here." And the more he tried to avoid it, the more it sucked him back in. And he was convinced that whatever this was, it was coming in and out of a different dimension, coming through at the ammo place and then into this world, and that it didn't want him to tell its story. There's a fascinating story where he took several people there to the ammo dump, and they walked through the area, and one of the ladies suddenly got terrified, and she screamed, "Oh my God, it just walked through me, whatever it was." And he turned to look at her, and the Mothman creature was right there between him and her, and then it stepped into the wall and was gone. And then, of course, things got creepier because the bridge blows up, collapses, and it's Christmas week, and the bridge is completely filled with people coming home from work and buying Christmas gifts. It's a very busy weekend, and the bridge collapses. All these people die. People had told him ahead of time, I just feel like I've had nightmares that I'm swirling in water, that I'm drowning. I just want to be away from all this. I'm not. And those are the people who died by drowning. So he begins to think that this is ultra-terrestrial, that these things are creating prophecy and then fulfilling it, and that they are not from other planets. They've been here living, coexisting with us, and learning how to manipulate us for a long time. And then he begins to wonder if they're eating our fear.
Couldn't be any more bizarre.
No. And if you think that's crazy, I've come across stories of smoke wraiths that have appeared out of nowhere. Fascinating stories. The first one I came across was 2003, place called Litchfield, California. The guy only lets his first name be used. His name is Mike. He goes outside his home to get a little fresh air and stretch his legs. It's late in the evening. And he'd been working on a work project at home, and he just needed a break. So he's outside when he sees what he describes as a cigar-like object in the sky, like a giant blimp, but no light. It's just moving through the night. Stand there watching it, and he's like, what the heck is that? When all of a sudden, he says a bright pink flash comes out of it, and standing there in front of him is a man made of smoke. Now, I'm going to read this to you. He looked like he was made of gray smoke, and his form was being illuminated by the moon. At that point, I didn't know what had happened to the object in the sky, since my eyes were transfixed on the man, or whatever it was, slowly walking toward me and my front door. I then heard the dogs in the neighborhood start bawling and howling and barking, as if they sensed this figure was there. At that point, I took a step back against my door and yelled, "Can I help you?" The thing was now less than 100 feet in front of me, still getting closer, made not a sound. It was a man made of smoke. He was 7 feet tall, very slim, and I could see no face, no hands, no arms, or no face, just arms, a head, legs, and body, so the outline. I quickly stepped back into my house, closed the door, and pulls down the blinds. He shuts everything. He locks the door. And he says, I turned all my lights out. And that's when it really freaked me. Oh, excuse me. Then he said, I was going to turn my lights out. And that's when it really freaked me out. The lights turned themselves out. I ran to the phone to call the police, and the phone was dead. Then there was a pounding on the door and on the walls and of my home, and the pounding was so loud and strong that things were literally flying off the shelves in my living room. I ran upstairs to grab a baseball bat to protect myself. See, he needed a gun. And he comes back down armed with the bat. He hears voices downstairs as though someone is chanting in a strange alien language. Remember that sing-song, monotonous chanting? I was scared, and nevertheless, I charged into the living room shouting and swinging the bat, breaking furniture, and this is what he says. I went downstairs and yelled, swinging the bat, and as I walked in the living room, the knocking lamps and breaking my TV began. They just started exploding. Then all of a sudden, the voices stopped. The lights went back on. I'm still shaking. I grabbed for the phone, and thank God it worked. I called the police. Officers came 10 minutes later and took a report. I could tell they didn't believe me. And they asked me if I were drinking or doing drugs. I've never seen a ghost. I've never had anything happen to me that was supernatural. Nothing whatsoever. But this has changed my mind and made me realize that we are not the only living things on this planet. We are sharing this planet with other things. And I don't know what they are, but I don't want to see them again. That's one story. There's multiple stories of these beings.
When you said he went and got a baseball bat, the first thing that went through my mind was Swing Away, Merrill.
Yep.
I don't know if you saw that movie, but.
Yeah. Now, let's take another little. I mean, I could go through and tell you all the rest of these stories because they're fascinating. People made out of fire, breathing fire. And what have you, but I'm going to take you down to, I'm going to take you to a story that I think was fascinating. This happened in 1866 in Bracken County, Kentucky. It was February 13th. Nathaniel Squires and his wife owned a plantation there when they began to hear servants and slaves in the their porters screaming. They woke in the middle of the night to them screaming, the yelling, and they saw that their bedroom was bathed in a blue flickering light. They thought that the outbuildings where the staff and the slaves and what have you lived were on fire. So they jump out of bed, headed in that direction, thinking, oh my God, we've got to get them out, you know, and help. And I just thought this was the most amazing story. This is what he claims and he encountered. He said, between the house and the quarters for the staff and the slaves, we saw a towering beast as tall as the cabin itself, with ape-like head, two small white horns situated above each eye, long arms covered in grayish hair, and in feline paws with huge crooked claws, as well as a long tail with a dart on the end, like a horn. There was fire flickering in its eyes, and its mouth exuded sheets of blue-colored flame. It's just insane. Indeed, the entire body had a thin sheen of fire on it, and like an oil burning on its flesh, and its flesh was composed of flame. As the frightened people backed away, the slaves are yelling, screaming, the staff from the inside of the house are cowering backward, and the flaming monstrosity then engulfed itself in a spiral column of flame, so intense and explosive that the entity could not be seen inside it, just as like a churning column of fire. And a few moments later, the flames went out and the creature was gone. Again, more and more of these stories, more and more of these stories, crazy amounts of these stories. I want to move on to talk a little bit about, we've talked about fairies and goblins and gnomes and all of that. We've talked about all of those things. And now I want to talk about men and, well, I want to talk about black-eyed children, because there's a theme running through all of this, and it's just insane. Creepiest thing. So we all heard the stories of black-eyed children. We've always heard the stories about how they come up to your car, their house, they knock, they ask you to let them in, they're insistent, and when you look into their eyes, you realize their eyes have no white, they're just that black thing. But there's a story I want to share from a lady in Vermont who shares her story in a magazine. She does not want her name. She doesn't want any publicity, but she tells the story. And she said she was at home in 2015. She was sleeping with her husband when all of a sudden there was this knock on their door. They lived in a very rural area. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning. The woman thought somebody had broken down. And because they lived on an unpaved road and it had been snowing all night, these people must have got stuck. And the only house around was hers. So she looks out the window and she doesn't see anybody on the road. She doesn't see anybody in the yard. You know, like if you're knocking on somebody's door, you might back up and like see if they're looking out the window and go, hey, I'm my car broke down. Nothing's there. There's no path from the road to the house that's broken, and she doesn't know what to make of it. And it's a horrible snowstorm is going. And then she notices some footprints in the snow, but they start on the sidewalk close to the house. They don't start out at the road or any place else. Now, she said that the motion sensitive lights on her house kicks on, and that's when she saw the footprints. So they yell and two kids step out off the porch, children. And she said, we went downstairs to investigate and we could see the children on the porch. They appeared to be about 8 years old, a boy and a girl. They were standing in the snow. They were not dressed for winter. They had weird outdated haircuts. They were gazing at the ground. And she's like, we felt really unnerved, repulsed. We didn't want to open the door, but dude, they're kids and it's freezing cold and they don't got coats. And, you know, what are you going to do? So her husband goes up and opens the door and says, what are you kids doing out tonight? And the kid's reply is, our parents will be here soon. Like, they feel really conflicted, but they don't know what else to do. They're like, I guess you better come in. How did you get a hold of your parents? The temperature is like 10 degrees out. They're, you know, so they let them come in. They go to towards the kitchen and they take the kids with them. They start making hot chocolate to get the kids warmed up. The kids kind of are staying in the shadow. She says that every time we asked them, or, you know, how did you get here? Where are your parents at? Can we call your parents? And the only thing the kids say the entire time is, our parents will be here soon. That's it. No, thank you. No, we're good. No, anything. And then all of a sudden, they both rise up immediately. And she said, I noticed that their voices had this weird sing-song monotone to it. And they said, we need to use the bathroom. And she said, her husband said, well, it's over here. Go up the, you know, the stairs here. And she's like, what the hell are you doing? And he's like, they'll be fine. And he turns around and his nose is bleeding, just gushing blood. And she screams, oh my gosh, your nose is bleeding. She makes a point of saying he's never had a nosebleed in his life. Never. This is the first time that she's ever seen it happen. And it's just rolling down. And she grabs, you know, a towel and she's runs to him and he's holding his head in his hands and he's like, oh my gosh, my head hurts so bad. I'm dizzy. She gets him seated and he's just gushing blood. The kids come back down. They sit down. She looks at them. She realizes that the first time the lights hit their faces, they don't have any white in their eyes. Their eyes are just black. They're not freaked out. They're like, oh, not saying, hey, mister, are you okay? Or can we help? They're just sitting there. They pick up their hot chocolate and they begin to drink it. She's terrified. And she said, they just look at her and they say, don't worry, our parents will be here soon. Then all the lights go out in the house, like somebody hit a pole or something. And she's coming back from the bathroom trying to get more towels to soak up the blood because he's just gushing blood. And the children say in the darkness, oh, our parents are here now. And they get up, they open the front door, they go outside, they leave the front door open. She runs to the front door. The snow is swirling. You know, the wind is blowing. It's freezing cold. Behind her, her husband's still gushing blood. And she said, I see a car sitting on the road with two tall men dressed up all in black. They're staring at the house. And then the kids come out, they get in the car, and they drive off. The power blinks back on a few seconds later. And this is from her interview. In the ensuing months, three of our cats went missing without a trace and were found eventually in a pool of blood in the middle of our living room floor. We took them to the vet and were told that they had massive internal hemorrhaging. My husband became afflicted with his constant mysterious nosebleeds and was diagnosed with a rare form of very aggressive terminal cancer. Then she said she herself was experiencing frequent nosebleeds now and had no discernible cause, as well as sudden spells of dizziness, and her health has dramatically deteriorated. And she said, please post this story. I believe all of this happened because we left the black-eyed children into our home. We've told everyone we could about the strange kids that showed up in the night, but none of them believe us. They laugh at us. Some of them say, why were you scared of the Mennonite kids? They don't understand what we're trying to tell them. My advice is, if you see anything like this, lock your doors, call the police, wait till morning. Don't make the same mistakes we did. I have another half dozen such stories of these kids bringing death and destruction and then disappearing. It's the same themes throughout history. First they're elves and fairies, then they're vampires and werewolves, then they're guys in spaceships, or you know, ships that sail the ocean, then guys in spaceships, big aliens, little aliens, grays, you know, humanoids coming and going and what have you. Then we get the winged creatures and then the black-eyed children, but they all bring the same thing. They bring a terrible mythology, and they may very well be a single central thing that portrays itself in whatever way our age of people would perceive it to be frightening. And they bring messages and they bring fear, and they are so absurd in some of the stories that nobody would ever believe you, but they get to feast off of you, whether it's the fear or the psychological pain or the blood or whatever it is that they're taking from you. They want something from you. They're controlling you. They're creating a mythology about you. And there's a really interesting quote where the person says, look at every religion. It is a misdiagnosis of the mythology of these creatures. If they can come as black-eyed children and winged bat-like creatures and vampires and fairies, what makes you think they can't come as angels and demons too? I don't know if that's true or it's not true, but what I do know is it's a fascinating concept, and it's something that all the people in the field, with very few exceptions, and there's a few, there's some heretics who have followed Jacques Vallée, who are now, you know, carrying on his work. But when somebody works that hard to tell me not to look in that direction, dude, I want to look in that direction. So that's my stories for tonight and my concept, and I really would love to hear what other folks think. Ultra-terrestrials, extraterrestrials, both, neither, what are they? So I bid all of our listeners good night, and don't answer the door if something's out there.